Introduction to the State and Revolution. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Dessalines. The State and Revolution. The Marxist Theory of the State and the Tasks of the Proletariat in the Revolution by Vladimir Lenin. Written in August to September 1917. First published in 1918. A note from the Lenin Internet Archive. Lenin wrote The State and Revolution in August and September 1917 when he was hiding from persecution from the provisional government. The need for such a theoretical work as this was mentioned by Lenin in the second half of 1916. It was then that he wrote his note on the Youth International, in which he criticized Bukharin's position on the question of the state, and promised to write a detailed article on what he thought to be the Marxist attitude to the state. In a letter to A.M. Kollontai on February 17, 1917, he said that he had almost got ready material on that question. This material was written in a small blue-covered notebook headed Marxism on the State. In it, Lenin had collected quotations from the works of Marx and Engels, and extracts from the books by Kautsky, Panikek, and Bernstein, with his own critical notes, conclusions, and generalizations. When Lenin left Switzerland for Russia in April 1917, he feared arrest by the provisional government and left the manuscript of Marxism on the State behind, as it would have been destroyed had he been caught. When in hiding after the July events, Lenin wrote in a note, "Entre nous, if I am kicked off, I ask you to publish my notebook, Marxism on the State." It got held up in Stockholm. It is bound in a blue cover. All the quotations from Marx and Engels are collected there, all those from Kautsky against Panikek. There are a number of remarks, notes, and formulas. I think a week's work would be enough to publish it. I consider it important because not only Plekhanov, but Kautsky too is confused. When Lenin received his notebook from Stockholm, he used the material he had collected as a basis for his book, The State and Revolution. According to Lenin's plan, The State and Revolution was to have consisted of 7 chapters, but he did not write the 7th, the experience of the Russian revolutions of 1905 and 1917, and only a detailed plan has remained. In a note to the publisher, Lenin wrote that if he was too slow in completing this, the 7th chapter, or should it turn out to be too bulky, the first 6 chapters should be published separately as Book 1. Originally, the name F.F. Ivanovsky is shown on the first page of the notebook manuscript as that of the author. Lenin intended to publish the book under that pseudonym, otherwise the provisional government would have confiscated it for his name alone. The book, however, was not printed until 1918, when there was no longer any need for the pseudonym. The second edition appeared in 1919. In this revision, Lenin added to Chapter 2 a new section, The Presentation of the Question by Marx in 1852. End of the note by Lenin Internet Archive. Preface to the first edition. The question of the state is now acquiring particular importance, both in theory and in practical politics. The imperialist war has immensely accelerated and intensified the process of transformation of monopoly capitalism into state monopoly capitalism. The monstrous oppression of the working people by the state, which is merging more and more with the all-powerful capitalist associations, is becoming increasingly monstrous. The advanced countries, we mean their hinterland, are becoming military convict prisons for the workers. The unprecedented horrors and miseries of the protracted war are making the people's position unbearable and increasing their anger. The world proletarian revolution is clearly maturing. The question of its relation to the state is acquiring practical importance. The elements of opportunism that accumulated over the decades of comparatively peaceful development have given rise to the trend of social chauvinism which dominated the official socialist parties throughout the world. This trend, socialism in words and chauvinism in deeds, Plekhanov, Potrasov, Brekovskaya, Rubanovich, and, in a slightly veiled form, Tseretelli, Chernov and company in Russia, Scheidemann, Lejeune, David and others in Germany, Renaudel, Gesde, and Van der Velde in France and Belgium, Hindman and the Fabians in England, etc., etc., is conspicuous for the base, servile adaptation of the leaders of socialism to the interest not only of their national bourgeoisie, but of their state. For the majority of the so-called great powers have long been exploiting and enslaving a whole number of small and weak nations. And the imperialist war is a war for the division and redivision of this kind of booty. The struggle to free the working people from the influence of the bourgeoisie in general, and of the imperialist bourgeoisie in particular, is impossible without a struggle against opportunist prejudices concerning the state. First of all, we examine the theory of Marx and Engels of the state, and dwell in particular detail on those aspects of this theory which are ignored or have been distorted by the opportunists. Then we deal specially with the one who is chiefly responsible for these distortions, Karl Kautsky, the best-known leader of the Second International, from 1889 to 1914, which has met with such miserable bankruptcy in the present war. Lastly, we sum up the main results of the experience of the Russian revolutions of 1905, and particularly of 1917. Apparently, the latter is now, early August 1917, completing the first stage of its development. But this revolution as a whole can only be understood as a link in a chain of socialist proletarian revolutions being caused by the imperialist war. The question of the relation of the socialist proletarian revolution to the state, therefore, is acquiring not only practical political importance, but also the significance of a most urgent problem of the day, the problem of explaining to the masses what they will have to do before long to free themselves from capitalist tyranny. The author, August 1917. End of preface to the first edition. Preface to the second edition. The present second edition is published virtually unaltered, except that section 3 has been added to chapter 2. The author, from Moscow, December 17th, 1918. End of introduction. Chapter 1. Class Society and the State. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Section 1. The State, a product of the irreconcilability of class antagonisms. What is now happening to Marx's theory has, in the course of history, happened repeatedly to the theories of revolutionary thinkers and leaders of oppressed classes fighting for emancipation. During the lifetime of great revolutionaries, the oppressing classes constantly hounded them, received their theories with the most savage malice, the most furious hatred, and the most unscrupulous campaigns of lies and slander. After their death, attempts are made to convert them into harmless icons, to canonize them, so to say, and to hallow their names to a certain extent for the consolation of the oppressed classes, and with the object of duping the latter, while at the same time robbing the revolutionary theory of its substance, blunting its revolutionary edge and vulgarizing it. Today, the bourgeoisie and the opportunists within the labor movement concur in this doctoring of Marxism. They omit, obscure, or distort the revolutionary side of this theory, its revolutionary soul. They push to the foreground and extol what is or seems acceptable to the bourgeoisie. All the social chauvinists are now, quote, Marxists. Don't laugh. And more frequently, German bourgeois scholars, only yesterday specialists in the annihilation of Marxism, are speaking of the, quote, national German Marx, who they claim educated the labor unions which are so splendidly organized for the purpose of waging a predatory war. In these circumstances, in view of the unprecedentedly widespread distortion of Marxism, our prime task is to reestablish what Marx really taught on the subject of the state. This will necessitate a number of long quotations from the works of Marx and Engels themselves. Of course, long quotations will render the text cumbersome and not help at all to make it popular reading, but we cannot possibly dispense with them. All, or at any rate all the most essential passages in the works of Marx and Engels on the subject of the state, must by all means be quoted as fully as possible, so that the reader may form an independent opinion of the totality of the views of the founders of scientific socialism, and of the evolution of those views, and so that their distortion by the Kautskyism now prevailing may be documentarily proved and clearly demonstrated. Let us begin with the most popular of Engels' works, The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State, the sixth edition of which was published in Stuttgart as far back as 1894. We have to translate the quotations from the German originals, as the Russian translations, while very numerous, are for the most part either incomplete or very unsatisfactory. Summing up his historical analysis, Engels says, quote, "The state is, therefore, by no means a power forced on society from without, just as little is it the reality of the ethical idea, the image and reality of reason, as Hegel maintains. Rather, it is a product of society at a certain stage of development. It is the admission that this society has become entangled in an insoluble contradiction with itself, that it has split into irreconcilable antagonisms, which it is powerless to dispel. But in order that these antagonisms, these classes with conflicting economic interests, might not consume themselves and society in fruitless struggle, it became necessary to have a power, seemingly standing above society, that would alleviate the conflict, and keep it within the bounds of order. And this power, arisen out of society, but placing itself above it, and alienating itself more and more from it, is the state." End quote. This expresses with perfect clarity the basic idea of Marxism with regard to the historical role and the meaning of the state. The state is a product and a manifestation of the irreconcilability of class antagonisms. The state arises where, when, and in so far as class antagonism objectively cannot be reconciled. And conversely, the existence of the state proves that the class antagonisms are irreconcilable. It is on this most important and fundamental point that the distortion of Marxism, proceeding along two main lines, begins. On the one hand, the bourgeois, and particularly the petty bourgeois, ideologists, compelled under the weight of indisputable historical facts to admit that the state only exists where there are class antagonisms and a class struggle, quote, correct Marx, in such a way as to make it appear that the state is an organ for the reconciliation of classes. According to Marx, the state could neither have arisen nor maintained itself had it been possible to reconcile classes. From what the petty bourgeois and Philistine professors and publicists say, with quite frequent and benevolent references to Marx, it appears that the state does reconcile classes. According to Marx, the state is an organ of class rule, an organ for the oppression of one class by another. It is the creation of order, which legalizes and perpetuates this oppression by moderating the conflict between classes. In the opinion of petty bourgeois politicians, however, order means the reconciliation of classes, and not the oppression of one class by another. To alleviate the conflict means reconciling classes, and not depriving the oppressed classes of definite means and methods of struggle to overthrow the oppressors. For instance, when in the Revolution of 1917, the question of the significance and role of the state arose in all its magnitude as a practical question demanding immediate action. And moreover, action on a mass scale. All the social revolutionaries and Mensheviks descended at once to the petty bourgeois theory that the state reconciles classes. Innumerable resolutions and articles by politicians of both these parties are thoroughly saturated with this petty bourgeois and Philistine reconciliation theory. That the state is an organ of the rule of a definite class which cannot be reconciled with its antipode, the class opposite to it, is something the petty bourgeois democrats will never be able to understand. Their attitude to the state is one of the most striking manifestations of the fact that our social revolutionaries and Mensheviks are not socialists at all, a point that we Bolsheviks have always maintained. But petty bourgeois democrats, using near-socialist phraseology. On the other hand, the Kautskyite distortion of Marxism is far more subtle. Theoretically, it is not denied that the state is an organ of class rule, or that class antagonisms are irreconcilable. But what is overlooked or glossed over is this. If the state is the product of the irreconcilability of class antagonisms, if it is a power standing above society and, quote, alienating itself more and more from it, it is clear that the liberation of the oppressed class is impossible, not only without a violent revolution, but also without the destruction of the apparatus of state power, which was created by the ruling class, and which is an embodiment of this alienation. As we shall see later, Marx very explicitly drew this theoretical self-evident conclusion on the strength of a concrete historical analysis of the tasks of the revolution. And, as we shall show in detail further on, it is this conclusion which Kautsky has forgotten and distorted. Section 2. Special bodies of armed men, prisons, etc. Engels continues, quote, as distinct from the old Gentile, tribal or clan, order, the state first divides its subjects according to territory, end quote. This division seems natural to us, but it costs a prolonged struggle against the old organization according to generations or tribes. Engels' quote continued, the second distinguishing feature is the establishment of a public power which no longer directly coincides with the population organizing itself as an armed force. This special public power is necessary because a self-acting armed organization of the population has become impossible since the split into classes. The public power exists in every state. It consists not merely of armed men, but also of material adjuncts, prisons, and institutions of coercion of all kinds, of which Gentile, clan, society knew nothing. End quote. Engels elucidates the concept of the power, which is called the state, a a power which arose from society but places itself above it and alienates itself more and more from it. What does this power mainly consist of? It consists of special bodies of armed men having prisons, etc., at their command. We are justified in speaking of special bodies of armed men because the public power, which is an attribute of every state, does not directly coincide with the armed population, with its self-acting armed organization. Like all great revolutionary thinkers, Engels tries to draw the attention of the class-conscious workers to what prevailing Philistinism regards as least worthy of attention, as the most habitual thing, hallowed by prejudices that are not only deep-rooted, but, one might say, petrified. A standing army and police are the chief instruments of state power, but how can it be otherwise? From the viewpoint of the vast majority of Europeans of the end of the 19th century, whom Engels was addressing, and who had not gone through or closely observed a single great revolution, it could not have been otherwise. They could not understand at all what a self-acting armed organization of the population was. When asked why it became necessary to have special bodies of armed men placed above society and alienating themselves from it, such as the police and a standing army, the West European and Russian Philistines are inclined to utter a few phrases borrowed from Spencer of Michailovsky to refer to the growing complexity of social life, the differentiation of functions, and so on. Such a reference seems scientific and effectively lulls the ordinary person to sleep by obscuring the important and basic fact, namely, the split of society into irreconcilable antagonistic classes. Were it not for the split, the self-acting armed organization of the population would differ from the primitive organization of a stick-wielding herd of monkeys, or of primitive men, or of men united in clans, by its complexity, its high technical level, and so on. But such an organization would still be possible. It is impossible because civilized society is split into antagonistic and, moreover, irreconcilably antagonistic classes, whose, quote, self-acting arming would lead to an armed struggle between them. A state arises, a special power is created, special bodies of armed men, and every revolution, by destroying the state apparatus, shows us the naked class struggle, clearly shows us how the ruling class strives to restore the special bodies of armed men which serve it, and how the oppressed class strives to create a new organization of this kind, capable of serving the exploited instead of the exploiters. In the above argument, Engels raises theoretically the very same question which every great revolution raises before us in practice, palpably, and, what is more, on a scale of mass action, namely, the question of the relationship between special bodies of armed men and the self-acting armed organization of the population. We shall see how this question is specifically illustrated by the experience of the European and Russian revolutions. But to return to Engels' exposition. He points out that sometimes, in certain parts of North America, for example, this public power is weak. He has in mind a rare exception in capitalist society, in those parts of North America in its pre-imperialist days where the free colonists predominated, but that, generally speaking, it grows stronger. Engels quote, "It, the public power, grows stronger, however, in proportion as class antagonisms within the state become more acute, and as adjacent states become larger and more populous. We have only to look at our present-day Europe, where class struggle and rivalry in conquest have tuned up the public power to such a pitch that it threatens to swallow the whole of society and even the state." End of Engels' quote. This was written not later than the early 90s of the last century, Engels' last preface being dated June 16, 1891. The turn towards imperialism, meaning the complete domination of the trusts, the omnipotence of the big banks, a grand-scale colonial policy, and so forth, was only just beginning in France, and was even weaker in North America and in Germany. Since then, rivalry in conquest has taken a gigantic stride, all the more because by the beginning of the second decade of the 20th century, the world had been completely divided up among these rivals in conquest, i.e., among the predatory great powers. Since then, military and naval armaments have grown fantastically, and the predatory war of 1914-17, for the domination of the world by Britain or Germany, for the division of the spoils, has brought the swallowing of all the forces of society by the rapacious state power close to complete catastrophe. Engels could, as early as 1891, point to rivalry in conquest as one of the most important distinguishing features of the foreign policy of the great powers, while the social chauvinist scoundrels have ever since 1914, when this rivalry many times intensified, gave rise to an imperialist war, been covering up the defense of the predatory interests of their own bourgeoisie with phrases about defense of the fatherland, defense of the republic and the revolution, etc. Section 3. The State, an instrument for the exploitation of the oppressed class. The maintenance of the special public power standing above society requires taxes and state loans. Having public power and the right to levy taxes, Engels writes, the officials now stand as organs of society, above society. The free, voluntary respect that was accorded to the organs of the Gentile, clan, constitution, does not satisfy them, even if they could gain it. Special laws are enacted proclaiming the sanctity and immunity of the officials. The shabbiest police servant has more authority than the representative of the clan, but even the head of the military power of a civilized state may well envy the elder of a clan the unrestrained respect of society. The question of the privileged position of the officials as organs of state power is raised here. The main point indicated is, what is it that places them above society? We shall see how this theoretical question was answered in practice by the Paris Commune in 1871, and how it was obscured from a reactionary standpoint by Kautsky in 1912. Engels' quote continued, because the state arose from the need to hold class antagonisms in check, but because it arose, at the same time, in the midst of the conflict of these classes, it is, as a rule, the state of the most powerful, economically dominant class, which, through the medium of the state, becomes also the politically dominant class, and thus acquires new means of holding down and exploiting the oppressed class. The ancient and feudal states were organs for the exploitation of the slaves and serfs. Likewise, the modern representative state is an instrument of exploitation of wage labor by capital. By way of exception, however, periods occur in which the warring classes balance each other so nearly that the state power, as ostensible mediator acquires, for the moment, a certain degree of independence of both. Such were the absolute monarchies of the 17th and 18th centuries, the Bonapartism of the First and Second Empires in France, and the Bismarck regime in Germany. End quote. Such, we may add, is the Kerensky government in Republican Russia, since it also began to persecute the revolutionary proletariat, at a moment when, owing to the leadership of the petty bourgeois democrats, the Soviets have already become impotent, while the bourgeoisie are not yet strong enough simply to disperse them. In a democratic republic, Engels continues, wealth exercises its power indirectly, but all the more surely. First, by means of the direct corruption of officials, as in America. Second, by means of an alliance of the government and the stock exchange in France and America. At present, imperialism and the domination of the banks have developed into an exceptional art, and both of these methods of upholding and giving effect to the omnipotence of wealth in democratic republics of all descriptions. Since, for instance, in the very first months of the Russian Democratic Republic, one might say during the honeymoon of the socialists, social revolutionaries, and Mensheviks joined in wedlock to the bourgeoisie in the coalition government. Mr. Palchinsky obstructed every measure intended for curbing the capitalists and their marauding practices, their plundering of the state by means of war contracts. And since later on Mr. Palchinsky, upon resigning from the cabinet, and being, of course, replaced by quite another similar Palchinsky, was, quote, rewarded by the capitalists with a lucrative job with a salary of 120,000 rubles per annum. What would you call that? Direct or indirect bribery? An alliance of the government and the syndicates, or merely friendly relations? What role do the Chernovs, Tseretellis, Avksentievs, and Skobelevs play? Are they the direct or only the indirect allies of the millionaire treasury looters? Another reason why the omnipotence of wealth is more certain in a democratic republic is that it does not depend on defects in the political machinery or on the faulty political shell of capitalism. A democratic republic is the best possible political shell for capitalism, and therefore, once capital has gained possession of this very best shell, through the Palchinskys, Chernovs, Tseretellis, and company, it establishes its power so securely, so firmly, that no change of persons, institutions, or parties in the bourgeois democratic republic can shake it. We must also note that Engels is most explicit in calling universal suffrage as well an instrument of bourgeois rule. Universal suffrage, he says, obviously taking account of the long experience of German social democracy, is, quote, the gauge of the maturity of the working class. It cannot and never will be anything more in the present day state. End quote. The petty bourgeois democrats, such as our socialist revolutionaries and Mensheviks, and also their twin brothers, all the social chauvinists and opportunists of Western Europe, expect just this more from universal suffrage. They themselves share and instill into the minds of the people the false notion that universal suffrage, in the present-day state, is really capable of revealing the will of the majority of the working people and of securing its realization. Here, we can only indicate this false notion, only point out that Engels' perfectly clear statement is distorted at every step in the propaganda and agitation of the, quote, official, i.e. opportunist, socialist parties. A detailed exposure of the utter falsity of this notion, which Engels brushes aside here, is given in our further account of the views of Marx and Engels on the present-day state. Engels gives a general summary of his views in the most popular of his works in the following words, beginning of quote. The state, then, has not existed from all eternity. There have been societies that did without it, that had no idea of a state and state power. At a certain stage of economic development, which was necessarily bound up with the split of society into classes, the state became a necessity owing to this split. We are now rapidly approaching a stage in the development of production at which the existence of these classes not only will have ceased to be a necessity, but will become a positive hindrance to production. They will fall as they arose at an earlier stage. Along with them, the state will inevitably fall. Society, which will reorganize production on the basis of a free and equal association of the producers, will put the whole machinery of the state where it will then belong, into a museum of antiquities, by the side of the spinning wheel and the bronze axe. End quote. We do not often come across this passage in the propaganda and agitation literature of the present-day Social Democrats. And even when we do come across it, it is mostly quoted in the same manner as one bows before an icon, i.e., it is done to show official respect for Engels, and no attempt is made to gauge the breadth and depth of the revolution that this relegating of the, quote, whole machinery of a state into the Museum of Antiquities implies. In most cases, we do not even find an understanding of what Engels calls the state machine. Section 4. The Withering Away of the State and Violent Revolution. Engels' words regarding the, quote, withering away of the state are so widely known. They are often quoted, and so clearly reveal the essence of the customary adaptation of Marxism to opportunism, that we must deal with them in detail. We shall quote the whole argument from which they are taken. Beginning of Engels' quote. The proletariat seizes from state power and turns the means of production into state property to begin with. But thereby it abolishes itself as the proletariat, abolishes all class distinctions and class antagonisms, and abolishes also the state as state. Society thus far, operating amid class antagonisms, needed the state, that is, an organization of the particular exploiting class, for the maintenance of its external conditions of production, and, therefore, especially, for the purpose of forcibly keeping the exploited class in the conditions of oppression determined by the given mode of production, such as slavery, serfdom or bondage, or wage labor. The state was the official representative of society as a whole, its concentration in a visible corporation. But it was this only insofar as it was the state of that class which itself represented, for its own time, society as a whole. In ancient times, the state of slave-owning citizens, in the Middle Ages of the feudal nobility, in our time of the bourgeoisie. When at last it becomes the real representative of the whole of society, it renders itself unnecessary. As soon as there is no longer any social class to be held in subjection, as soon as class rule and the individual struggle for existence based on the present anarchy in production, with the collisions and excesses arising from this struggle, are removed, nothing more remains to be held in subjection, nothing necessitating a special coercive force, a state. The first act by which the state really comes forward as the representative of the whole of society, the taking possession of the means of production in the name of society, is also its last independent act as a state. State interference in social relations becomes, in one domain after another, superfluous, and then dies down of itself. The government of persons is replaced by the administration of things and by the conduct of processes of production. The state is not, quote, abolished. It withers away. This gives the measure of the value of the phrase, quote, a free people's state, both as to its justifiable use for a long time from an agitational point of view, and as to its ultimate scientific insufficiency, and also of the so-called anarchist's demand that the state be abolished overnight. Quoted from Antidurum. It is safe to say that of this argument of Engels, which is so remarkably rich in ideas, only one point has become an integral part of socialist thought among modern socialist parties, namely that, according to Marx, that state withers away, as distinct from the anarchist doctrine of the abolition of the state. To prune Marxism to such an extent means reducing it to opportunism, for this, quote, interpretation, only leaves a vague notion of a slow, even gradual change, of absence of leaps and storms, of absence of revolution. The current, widespread, popular, if one may say so, conception of the, quote, withering away of the state undoubtedly means obscuring, if not repudiating, revolution. Such an interpretation, however, is the crudest distortion of Marxism, advantageous only to the bourgeoisie. In point of theory, it is based on disregard for the most important circumstances and considerations indicated in, say, Engels' summary argument that we have just quoted in full. In the first place, at the very outset of his argument, Engels says that, in seizing state power, the proletariat thereby, quote, abolishes the state as state. It is not done to ponder over and over the meaning of this. Generally, it is either ignored altogether, or is considered to be something in the nature of, quote, Hegelian weakness on Engels' part. As a matter of fact, however, these words briefly express the experience of one of the greatest proletarian revolutions, the Paris Commune of 1871, of which we shall speak in greater detail in its proper place. As a matter of fact, Engels speaks here of the proletarian revolution, quote, abolishing the bourgeois state, while the words about the state withering away refer to the remnants of the proletarian state after the socialist revolution. According to Engels, the bourgeois state does not wither away, but it is abolished by the proletariat in the course of the revolution. What withers away after this revolution is the proletarian state, or semi-state. Secondly, the state is a special coercive force. Engels gives this splendid and extremely profound definition here with the utmost lucidity. And from it follows that the special coercive force for the suppression of the proletariat by the bourgeoisie, of millions of working people by handfuls of the rich, must be replaced by a, quote, special coercive force for the suppression of the bourgeoisie by the proletariat, i.e., the dictatorship of the proletariat. This is precisely what is meant by the abolition of the state as state. This is precisely the act of taking possession of the means of production in the name of society. And it is self-evident that such a replacement of one bourgeois, quote, special force, by another, proletarian special force, cannot possibly take place in the form of withering away. Thirdly, in speaking of the state withering away, and the even more graphic and colorful, quote, dying down of itself, Engels refers quite clearly and definitely to the period after, quote, the state has taken possession of the means of production in the name of the whole of society, that is, after the socialist revolution. We all know that the political form of the state at that time is the most complete democracy, but it never enters the head of any of the opportunists who shamelessly distort Marxism that Engels is consequently speaking here of the democracy dying down of itself, or withering away. This seems very strange at first sight, but it is incomprehensible only to those who have not thought about democracy also being a state, and consequently also disappearing when the state disappears. Revolution alone can abolish the bourgeois state. The state in general, i.e., the most complete democracy, can only, quote, wither away. Fourthly, after formulating his famous proposition that the state withers away, Engels at once explains specifically that this proposition is directed against both the opportunists and the anarchists. In doing this, Engels puts in the forefront that conclusion, drawn from the proposition that the state withers away, which is directed against the opportunists. One can wager that out of every 10,000 persons who have heard or read about the withering away of the state, 9,999,000 of them are completely unaware or do not remember that Engels directed his conclusions from that proposition, not against anarchists alone. And of the remaining 10, probably 9 do not know the meaning of a free people state, or why an attack on this slogan means an attack on opportunists. This is how history is written. This is how a great revolutionary teaching is imperceptibly falsified and adapted to the prevailing Philistinism. The conclusion directed against the anarchists has been repeated thousands of times. It has been vulgarized and rammed into people's heads in the shallowest form, and has acquired the strength of a prejudice, whereas the conclusion directed against the opportunists has been obscured and forgotten. The free people state was a program demand and a catchword current among the German Social Democrats in the 70s. This catchword is devoid of all political content, except that it describes the concept of democracy in a pompous Philistine fashion. Insofar as it hinted in a legally permissible manner at a democratic republic, Engels was prepared to, quote, justify its use for a time from an agitational point of view. But it was an opportunist catchword, for it amounted to something more than prettifying bourgeois democracy, and was also a failure to understand the socialist criticism of the state in general. We are in favor of a democratic republic as the best form of state for the proletariat under capitalism. But we have no right to forget that wage slavery is the lot of the people, even in the most democratic bourgeois republic. Furthermore, every state is a, quote, special force for the suppression of the oppressed class. Consequently, every state is not free and not a people's state. Marx and Engels explained this repeatedly to their party comrades in the 70s. Fifthly, the same work of Engels, whose arguments about the withering away of the state everyone remembers, also contains an argument of the significance of violent revolution. Engels' historical analysis of its role becomes a veritable panegyric on violent revolution. This no one remembers. It is not done in modern socialist parties to talk or even think about the significance of this idea, and it plays no part whatever in their daily propaganda and agitation among the people. And yet, it is inseparably bound up with the withering away of the state into a harmonious whole. Here is Engels' argument. That force, however, plays yet another role, other than that of a diabolical power, in history, a revolutionary role, that, in the words of Marx, it is the midwife of every old society which is pregnant with a new one, that it is the instrument with which social movement forces its way through and shatters the dead, fossilized political forms. Of this there is not a word in Herr Döring. It is only with sighs and groans that he admits the possibility that force will perhaps be necessary for the overthrow of an economy based on exploitation. Unfortunately, because all use of force demoralizes, he says, the person who uses it. And this in Germany, where a violent collision, which may, after all, be forced on the people, would at least have the advantage of wiping out the servility which has penetrated the nation's mentality following the humiliation of the 30 Years' War. Footnote: The 30 Years' War from 1618 to 48, the first European war, resulted from an aggravation of the antagonisms between various alignments of European states, and took the form of a struggle between Protestants and Catholics. It began with a revolt in Bohemia against the tyranny of the Habsburg monarchy and the onslaught of the Catholic reaction. The states which then entered the war formed two camps: the Pope, the Spanish and the Austrian Habsburgs, and the Catholic princes of Germany, who rallied to the Catholic Church, opposed the Protestant countries, Bohemia, Denmark, Sweden, the Dutch Republic, and a number of German states that had accepted the Reformation. The Protestant countries were backed by the French kings, enemies of the Habsburgs. Germany became the chief battlefield and the object of military plunder and predatory claims. The war ended in 1648 with the signing of the Peace Treaty of Westphalia, which completed the political dismemberment of Germany. End footnote. Engels' quote continued, "And this